talking about Moses in the early years of Moses' life, the first 80 years, at this time that we're coming back to talk to Moses or see about Moses again. He's probably older than any of us in here are today. Maybe not by much for some of us, but he's about 80 years old. And of course, we realize that he was raised basically in the house of Pharaoh, the house of the king. He was raised probably to be a leader of men. Some traditions indicate that he was a general in the Egyptian army, which is certainly a possibility. But he was raised, trained as a leader of men. He spent the next 40 years of his life after fleeing from Pharaoh as a shepherd, apparently in the wilderness over there. And so he learned how to be a leader of men. He learned how to live in the desert. So we see Moses has spent the first 80 years of his life being trained for the next 40 years, which he's going to lead the children of Israel in that desert where he has spent the last 40 years of his life. So we're going to go into it now with Moses at the burning bush. So we're turning in now to the point where he is going back to lead Israel to bring them out of the land of Egypt. And they're going to spend the next 40 years wandering in that wilderness where he shepherded sheep. So before we get into the class specifically, though, let's open the class with a word of prayer. Bill Downey, could you lead us in that prayer, please? One of the things that we learned about Moses in this last lesson was he was an individual with a sense of fairness. He intervened between an Egyptian who was dealing unfairly with an Israelite. He tried to intervene between two Israelites who were having a quarrel, and he approached the man who was the offender in that particular case and tried to straighten that out. When he arrived over in the land of Midian, he found there a situation where the daughters of a man who became his father-in-law were coming out to water the sheep. They drew the water, put it in the trough, and then some of the other shepherds, the male shepherds, apparently came by and drove them off so they could water their sheep with what the girls had already done. Moses said, "This isn't right, this isn't fair," and intervened in that situation as well. So we see Moses as an individual with a strong sense of fairness. At least in the first 40 years of his life, we can see that as one of the things that was very noteworthy about Moses. So we see now here that we're in Exodus chapter 2. It says, "Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them." So at this point, we see that God has decided it's now time to bring the children of Israel back out of Egypt, back away from the bondage that has been plaguing them now. So we go on here, and it says, "Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian." It's kind of interesting, this priest of Midian. We don't know priest of what God. We're not given any information with regard to that. He is referred to as a priest of Midian. Midian, of course, being a descendant of Abraham, there was certainly the possibility that this individual is a priest of Jehovah to the Midianites. There were individuals at this time who were not Israelites who were still following Jehovah. the possibility here with Jethro exists. We know that it existed with Balaam. So we know that that's a possibility. But he was a priest of Midian. He led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, and yet the bush was not consumed. And we notice here that it says that the angel of the Lord appeared, indicating that this was not Jehovah himself who was in the burning bush, but an angel. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. So is it Jehovah in the bush, or is it an angel in the bush? In reality, it doesn't matter. It is the words of Jehovah that is calling to him from the bush. And he said, here I am. And then he said, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said also, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. So the idea that you could not look at God and survive certainly goes way, way back. We certainly see it here in Moses. And Moses is certainly not being rather brash and foolhardy here. He's being very respectful to God. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to a place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite, the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. So God says, I see what's going on down there. I know about it, and I understand it. He had reasons for wanting them to be out of the land of Canaan for this period of time. And that has now been fulfilled. The iniquity of the Amorite is apparently full at this time, whatever that involved. And so God is going to bring the children of Israel back and give them the land that he promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, so that these people have this hope to look forward to. Now, if going on, therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Then Moses said to God, behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Now this is a question that may have come up with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're not really told, but God has never apparently been given a name that would be common among the peoples. If you look at the Egyptians, among whom Moses had been raised, and they had many gods, and they all had names so that you could identify which god you were talking to. So it's natural for Moses to want to know what is his God's name. What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. Bill?
It would be a common name. contrast to every other god that isn't. You know, I am, they're not. You know? I don't know if that would be one of the sort of that I'm my Cain god, or I, well, that is, I'm always.
Yes.
Been here. And so I don't know which, if you can, it's interesting. I mean, that's an important, I mean, here's the name of that. At least in my mind is what I think of when I hear that.
And yes, there's some, Mike?
I don't mean to jump ahead, but Christ himself in the book of John, kind of an elusive way in some respects, the fact that he is, and that name applied to him in John 8.
Okay.
You were going to touch on that or not?
No, I had no plans to. I'm not really going to go into this name any further. I have had no plans to anyway.
I just thought it was significant.
It may be. So, the gods of the lands around them all had names, and we see Dagon and Molech, and as you go on through the Bible, there's many gods that are named. But this is the name of God. And the children of Israel tend to hold this in great reverence, most of the time refusing to even state it out loud or write it. So he goes on telling Moses, he says, "Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, and the Hivite, the Jebusite, a land flowing with milk and honey. They will pay heed to what you say, and you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt and will say to him, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be when you go, you will not go empty handed. For every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house, articles of silver, articles of gold and clothing. You will put them on your sons and daughters, thus you will plunder the Egyptians.'" So God is telling him just how this is going to work out, at least in general terms. We see the outline. You're going to go down there, you're going to gather the leaders of Israel together, and there's a group going to go to Pharaoh and say, "We want to go 3 days wilderness into the 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may worship to God." Their worship would apparently have been offensive to the Egyptians, and so they can't do it in the land of Egypt. So they're going to have to go out of the land of Egypt. But he says Pharaoh's not going to listen. He's not going to agree to this, because he's going to expect just what would happen is that you're not coming back. And they, as we see this going on, we get more details of just why this was and how this was and what they were saying to them. But he's telling them, this is what's going to happen, and I'm going to do a series of miracles in Egypt, and they're basically, in the end, they're going to drive you out. So it's not going to be a matter of them letting you go. It's going to be a matter of them pushing you, forcing you to go out of the land of Egypt. You know, we can also see some things here that God has done that seems strange to us. But suppose that the children of Israel had been living in peace there in the land of Egypt. They had no problems at all with the Egyptians. Everything was going just great. Moses shows up and says, "Let's go to the land of Canaan." What's the answer going to be? "You're crazy. I'm comfortable here. I'm not moving." So the affliction that God had inflicted upon, or that the Egyptians had inflicted upon the people of God, had a purpose. And it served God's purpose. It made them willing to get up and go when God said go. So we can see the purposes of God in some of this, and it's like I say, seems strange to us that God would allow these kind of things to take place. But he did in order that it might serve his purpose. Mike?
And you can also look at the statement that God makes about them plundering the Egyptians as they leave. You know, you would think, well, God has them plunder the Egyptians? But consider, God saw this as the things that the Egyptians had withheld from them as their rightful, you know, for the labor that they had done.
Right.
And so God justifies the books, if you will, in this way. As they're leaving, they get what they truly deserve.
Yeah, I think there's no real doubt about that either, that God gave them what they would need in the wilderness, and he got back from the Egyptians the things they had withheld from them. Joe? Oh, the Israelites were very much plagued. I'm saying, if they had been living in peace and comfort in Egypt, when Moses came back and said, let's go back to Canaan, what's their answer going to be under that circumstance? Not the circumstance they're really under.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, if you misunderstood, it's probably others did too. So, but yeah, if they had been living in great comfort in Egypt, why leave? I mean, they got everything they needed. They would have everything they wanted. As it was, they were under oppression. They were very much being mistreated. And so getting them to leave was not so much of a chore as it would have been had it been the other way around. Dan?
I think it's he brought him into the land in peace and in plenty. See the bad clearly in our lives for our good.
Okay. Andrew and then Bill?
I love that slide.
Okay.
Bill? I appreciate the hardships that brought about the purpose that God wanted, right? And now Moses in his life, it brings about the purpose that God had in Moses.
Yes. Dorothy?
Wow. We're going through them. More than that's going through them because he is
over. Okay. All right. So going on, still at the burning bush. Then Moses said, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you. The Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. And he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail. So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. The Lord furthermore said to him, now put your hand into your bosom. So he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous, like snow. Then he said, put your hand into your bosom again. So he put his hand into his bosom again. When he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. If they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of the last sign. But if they will not believe either of these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. So God gives Moses three signs he can give to the children of Israel that indeed this is that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has appeared to him and is the one who is sending him to do these things. So he never seems to send somebody without credentials, put it that way. When we got the Bible, we got it from people who had credentials. They were able to work miracles in the times of the apostles and the people writing the New Testament. We can believe this was true in terms of those writing the Old Testament as well, that God had spoken to them. And that certainly at times we see the credentials that these men had when it came to doing this. Now, oftentimes like in the times of Jeremiah, he really didn't need miracles. The people at that time were believing in Jehovah, just not being faithful to him. But when he needs them, he wants to put out something new. He's got someone with credentials. He's given them the credentials they need to prove that what they're saying is true. I think that seemed like, did we skip something? We did. Okay, so then Moses said to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you have spoken to your servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." So Moses probably had some kind of a speech problem, at least. Never been one who could get up and be an eloquent speaker for all of his 80 years of life. But the Lord said to him, "Who is it that made man's mouth? Or who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then go, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say." But he said, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will." So Moses isn't anxious to take on this job. And if we look at the next 40 years of his life and think about it, I don't think I want that job either. But God says, go. This is the last time we see Moses saying, "I don't want to." Then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, "Is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he speaks fluently. And moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and his mouth, and I will teach you what you are to do. Moreover, he shall speak to you, for you to the people, and he will be as a mouth for you, and you shall be as God to him. You shall take in your hand this staff, with it you shall perform the signs." And so God says, okay, I'll give in on this much. You're going to go, you're going to lead the people. If you can't be an eloquent speaker, we'll let Aaron do the speaking for you. But you tell Aaron what to say, and Aaron will say it. We get some translations and verses to say that Aaron's going to be your prophet. You're going to be as God to Aaron, and he's going to be your prophet. He's going to be the one speaking for Moses. Moses is getting the message from God and passing it on to Aaron, and Aaron is speaking for Moses to the people. In some ways, this actually probably works better because it makes Moses seem to be a higher ranking individual. He has somebody else who is speaking for him. He doesn't bend down to do the speaking himself. So these are the things that God has told him that is going to work out. And a prophet does not necessarily mean one who is speaking for God. We tend to think of it that way, but a prophet can be one who is speaking for someone else. Bill?
Yeah, I think of leprosy and the staff into a snake, which obviously Moses had never seen happen before, that he would have some confidence that God can make him speak. Work with Moses and not
yes.
Insist that he, the godless, gives a bit there.
That God has the power to be dictatorial, but is often not. We see that throughout the Bible. We see those kind of situations arising. Moses' excuse is probably just that, too. It's an excuse. I think Moses probably has no doubt that God can make him an eloquent speaker, because what we see in the rest of Moses' life, that God says, jump, and he says, how high? After he's airborne. He immediately does what God tells him to do. But at this point in time, he's not wanting to get out and do it. And We find other places Moses described as one of the most humble men alive. Though he was not one who saw himself as being in a much higher position than he really had. He saw himself at this point in time as a shepherd. And that was satisfying to him. He was content with that. Much as the Apostle Paul said, he was content in any situation. Moses had gone from being a powerful man in Egypt to being a shepherd in the wilderness, and he was content in both cases. Don?
I was just thinking of a contrast of Moses on Mount Sinai as opposed to Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane.
And in the end, Moses did what God asked him to do.
I think Jesus' attitude was
the life. Amen.
Okay. I won't disagree with that, Dan. Yeah, well, Moses was comfortable in being a shepherd in the land of Midian. I think he had some doubts about wanting to change that. Yes?
The problem is that sometimes he's not a good speaker, and so therefore a duty. But the Lord knows what you are capable of. That tells us that sometimes if you are a Christian and the Lord is in you, it's a real life.
Okay. So Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Please let me go that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. The Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders that I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn.'" So this is what God is telling Moses, that he can promise Pharaoh that if you don't let the children of Israel go, I'm going to kill your firstborn. And that, of course, was a very, 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 very severe threat to anyone. But of course, Pharaoh is the king and his son is well protected, so he has nothing that he has to be concerned about, right? He's dealing with some slaves here, not anyone with any power. Now here's an interesting point. It came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet and said, she said, "You have are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone. At that time, she said, "You are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision." Now, we note here that apparently Moses had not followed the practice of circumcision while in Midian. The Israelites had kept up the practice in Egypt, or they were circumcised before leaving Egypt, and I don't know right offhand which one it was. But in Joshua 5, it says, At that time the Lord said to Joshua, "Make yourself flint knives and circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time." So Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeah Haraloth. This is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war died in the wilderness along the way after they came out of Egypt. For all the people who came out were circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. So, I don't know. Moses, for some reason, had not been following the practice of circumcision while in Midian. Which seems a little strange to us, but then again, we really don't know what was going on there. Obviously, the Midianites had not been following that practice either, even though they were descendants of Abraham. and would have had that in their past. But that's several hundred years in their past, and things like that could be given up fairly easily. Bill?
Yeah, not to give us any chance. We're just about killed in there. But anyway, I'm not saying that we should be thinking that our lives should be lax. But when we do fall short, it's good to know God is patient.
And the other aspect of it would be Moses bringing his sons back to the children of Israel who were circumcised was going to be a sign to them that he wasn't who he said he was. So there's that as well. Andrew?
I was going to say that he was kowtowing
for... Okay, that's very probable. In fact, that since his wife was opposed to the practice, he hadn't pushed the issue. Of course, none of us would do anything like that, right? If God says, do it this way, and our wife says, no, we're not going to push the issue. But still, God insisted that it be done. And that was enough to get it done there at this time. We also note that in this, that Moses hadn't been necessarily following all of God's command rigorously. He had failed in some areas, in some circumstances, which should be comforting to us as well, because we fail, and as Bill said, God is patient with us as he was with Moses. Now the Lord said to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel, and Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he performed the signs in the sight of the people, so the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, that they had seen their affliction, they bowed low and worshipped. So they go back, and the children of Israel are quite willing to accept them. But we're going to see that this acceptance is somewhat conditional. He's given them hope, which is always a good thing to give them. But when they don't get immediate gratification, that's not going to be quite so good. And people are still people. That these people aren't reacting any different than people do today. That you hear a politician get up and promise you immediate gratification, he gets the votes. Someone says, look, I can give you immediate gratification, but what that's going to result in the long term is going to be much more painful. What we really need to do is do something else that won't give you immediate gratification, but in the long term will be much better. The guy promising immediate gratification is going to get the votes. That's the way it works in a democratic society, which is one of the problems with a democratic society. You don't have anybody looking out for the long term. Everybody is looking for the short term. The politician is just looking for the votes that he can get. This we're going to notice among the people here, that at this point in time, they're very glad that Moses is there. And afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. The Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go. This man is arrogant in the extreme. We see that as we go on through all of this, is that this is an individual who really considers himself as just the height of, and he probably is the most powerful man in the world at this particular point in time. And boy, he knows it, and he's not going to let anybody forget it. Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Otherwise, he will fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. But the king of Egypt said to him, Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors. Again, Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors? So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and their foremen, saying, "You are no longer to give the people straw to make brick as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks which they were making previously you shall impose on them. You are not to reduce any of it, because they are lazy. Therefore they cry out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Let the labor be heavier on the men. Let them work at it, so they will pay no attention to false words." So, again, he's got a short-term answer here. Boy, I'm going to make it harder on them, and they'll have to bow down and just, because I am the most powerful man in the world. And so this is the kind of arrogance, and this is the kind of thing we often see in our lives today, too. People looking for short-term solutions when long-term solutions to a problem are what is needed. Mike?
And let's not forget that when Moses appeared before Pharaoh, it wasn't just one man talking to another man about believing a different religion. It was one man standing in front of a man who was persuaded that he is God, that he is one of the gods. And so for Moses to stand there and assert that the God of Israel would take preeminence over his authority as one of the gods of Egypt clearly didn't fly in his thinking at all.
I agree with that 100%. And that's something we need to recognize. Many of those kings in the old times, they considered themselves gods as well. And that other people were looking up to them and calling them gods and worshiping the king. We see that even in the time of Christ with the Roman emperors, that they had taken upon themselves that they were deity. And so as people get more and more powerful, it is more and more tempting for them to say, "Wow, there is nobody more powerful than I. I must be God." And away they want to go with that. But again, people are people. They weren't any different in those days than they are today. Then the foremen of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, "Why do you deal this way with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants, yet they keep saying to us, 'Make bricks.' And behold, your servants are being beaten. But if it is the fault of it is the fault of your own people." But he said, "You are lazy, very lazy. Therefore you say, 'Let us go sacrifice to the Lord.' So go now and work, for you have been given no straw, yet you must deliver the quota of bricks." The foremen of the sons of Israel saw that they were in trouble, because they were told, "You must not reduce your daily amount of bricks." When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them. And they said to them, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight, in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us." So, moments ago, they were bowing down and worshiping God and looking with this bright hope. And now that, oh no, you're just causing more and more trouble for us. You're not getting anything out of this. So the people, even though they have probably seen some of these, they've seen the miracles, heard the words of the miracles, I suspect it was the leaders who had seen the miracles, but they had been told and passed down to the people that these miracles had taken place. But these people aren't buying it, that, yeah, Moses is something that really needs to, we really need to be listening to. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, "O Lord, why have you brought harm to this people? Why did you ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done harm to this people, and yet you have not delivered your people at all." So, doubt on Moses' part. "God, are you really doing this the right way? Isn't there something better that we could do?" Now, God had warned Moses. Pharaoh's going to say no. Moses should have been expecting that. But apparently he hadn't expected the reaction of Pharaoh here to saying, "You will get your own straw and still make as many bricks as you were making before." So Moses is capable of doubt, just as any of us are. "God, is this really what you want me to be doing? Are we doing this right? Is there something wrong of what we're going on? It's again, Moses is a man like any of the rest of us. We see as time goes on, his faith develops to much, much stronger faith than he'd had in the past. Mike?
And we also see that God's command does not diminish or take back seat to human opposition. And that's something we need to be aware of today, because there's so many places where we know what God has commanded, and yet we know that there, if we speak up or if we say something that we know to be true, we're going to face opposition by other people or even by our government. And yet,
okay,
we don't have any less of a responsibility.
All right. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for under compulsion he will let them go, and under compulsion he will drive them out of the land, out of his land." So God's answering Moses directly here and telling him this is what it's going to be. God spoke further to Moses and said to him, "I am the Lord, and I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they sojourned. Furthermore, I have heard the groaning of the sons of Israel because of the Egyptians for holding them in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the sons of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage. I will also redeem you with an outstretched hand and with great judgments. Then I will take you for my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you to the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord." So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage. So God says, "I've got a plan, and I'm going to execute that plan." And but the people, they don't want to hear it. Now, we got too much trouble now. It's just not going to work out. We just can't do this. It's just getting worse and worse. So, like I say, we tend to look at these people and wonder, why could they be this way? No different than we are. Bill?
And how patient are we when we're asking God to help us with something? And we often get impatient. It's easy to look back at them and think harshly, but that's human nature.
It's human nature, and like I say, we don't behave any differently. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Go tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the sons of Israel go out of his land." Then Moses spoke before the Lord, saying, "Behold, the sons of Israel have not listened to me. How will Pharaoh listen to me? For I am unskilled in speech." And the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, and gave them a charge to the sons of Israel and to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. Now it came about on the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "I am the Lord. Speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I speak to you." But Moses said before the Lord, "Behold, I am unskilled in speech. How will then Pharaoh listen to me?" So Moses is still, he's arguing this point with God that I'm not an eloquent speaker. I really can't do a very good job of that. And you know we skipped a bunch of verses in there. But God tells us to do something, then we need to be doing it and not to argue about it. Then the Lord said to Moses, "See, I will make you as God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet." We note here this use of the term prophet, which is different than the term we often use for the word prophet, because prophet to most of us is one who speaks for God. But that's not the definition of the word itself. "You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh, and he let the sons of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. When Pharaoh does not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my host, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. So Moses and Aaron did it as the Lord commanded them, thus they did. Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. So we get their ages here just thrown in as an aside, apparently. But this is what it is to say. But God is telling them, you do what I tell you to do and recognize that I'm going to convince the Egyptians that I am God and that they will eventually turn around and let the people go because that of the signs and wonders that God is going to show them to convince them, to convince the Egyptians that he is a God that is more powerful than the gods that they have in their land, including Pharaoh himself, who they revered as a god, or as a manifestation of one of their gods anyway. Okay, our time is, we've got about, I think we're going to stop here. We'll go back into it in the rod becoming a serpent in front of Pharaoh next week. Bill?
So here's this God Pharaoh, at least that's the way he looks at it. He had a certain district of his province that was wanting to go off. And I was going to look if he bows down to them. But if he lets them, these are my slaves, I'm going to let them do what, yeah, obviously it takes quite a few plagues for them to even consider, right?
And the hand of God really was acting on Pharaoh as well.
Yes.
But he was working with the tools that Pharaoh already had there for him to work with. Andrew?
Questions about this idea that I will harden Pharaoh's heart.
Okay. It's a fair question. I'm not sure it's one we can give a definitive answer to. But I think we note here that Pharaoh has a tool. His arrogance is what God is working upon in order to harden his heart. I think we'd see that is probably what we've got to deal with there. Okay, but you might be thinking about that. Does Pharaoh have free will, or is God forcing him to act in the way that he acts? It's not one we necessarily have a solid answer to.